26, 56 degrees in both Racine and Kenosha. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
To the Tuesday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. Most of us are very, very well acquainted with the term DEI, which stands for Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion. It is, in a sense, a movement afoot in much of America. It is also a movement that sometimes generates vigorous opposition, sometimes misguided concerns, sometimes stirs up all kinds of fears, unfounded and otherwise. I really appreciate a thoroughly written and beautifully written book on the topic called From Intention to Impact, A Practical Guide to Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion. And it is written by a woman who has been very much at the forefront of some of these efforts, Malia Lazu, a lecturer in the Technological Innovation, Entrepreneurship, and Strategic Management Group at MIT Sloan School of Management. MIT, of course, is Massachusetts Institute of Technology. She also brings to the table considerable experience in corporate America, including former executive vice president and regional president of Berkshire Bank, and the creator of the consultancy firm known as the Lazu Group. She's responsible for several accelerators designed to support minority-owned businesses in and around Boston. She draws on all of that real-life experience, as well as the experience of working side-by-side with the great and much-missed Harry Belafonte. And this has informed much of her work as an activist on behalf of the cause of greater diversity, equity, and inclusion in every facet of American life, but particularly corporate America. Again, her book, published by MIT Press, is From Intention to Impact, A Practical Guide to Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion. Malia Lazu, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you so much for having me.
I have to say, I really enjoyed this book, and I enjoyed it even more than I expected to. And I want to explain what I mean by that, because I think often when we take in hand a book that is confronting this really kind of tough and somewhat complicated topic, it can be kind of overwhelming, disconcerting, and sometimes kind of depressing. And I felt like your book was none of those things. It's written with exceptional clarity and also with a spirit of optimism and practicality in terms of getting about the work of getting some of this done in a really meaningful way. I wonder how much that was tied up in your intention as you sat down to write this book, to put down your thoughts on paper.
It absolutely was tied into my intention, and it reflects how I try to do the work, you know, writ large, right? I mean, it's so important for us to be optimistic and for us to understand that these problems were created so they can be solved, right? We created them. It's not some outside force. And we should be optimistic about that. And, you know, I'm also optimistic because the future seems to be a lot more interconnected than our past. And I think as we look at you know, the global economy of the 21st century, bringing people with different lived experience in just makes common sense.
One of the things you say, I think it's in the introduction to the book, is that writing this book was an emotional journey for you. Can you explain the way in which that was true?
Yeah, and, you know, I put that in the book because I thought it was important for people to know that these aren't just words, right? Diversity, equity, inclusion, it's not just a checklist, but it's actually how we recognize the value of different people. And while I was writing this book, you know, we're having this conversation in the U.S. and, you know, many folks are wanting to see a reversal. And it was, you know, I started writing this book and women had more rights than they have now, right? You know, different lived experiences were valued in college admissions. And, you know, those things were happening as I was putting the final edits to this book. And it just made me realize how much I wanted people to read this book and understand there were things that we can do to not go backwards, that the bit of connectivity that we've been able to build with one another in spite of it all can really continue.
Hmm. You have a really great line at one point in the book when you say DEI work seems hard on the best days and impossible on the worst. And I really appreciate that touch of honesty. And yet, there's another line in the book that I really, really love that in some respects would almost seem to contradict those words I just read. You write at one point, DEI work is not rocket science. It's actually elementary. What's interesting is you think about, you know, your choice of words there is that you didn't say DEI work is actually easy. You used the word elementary instead. I wonder if you could just talk for a moment about what, in a sense, might seem like a contradictory, or certainly it's a quandary, the fact that this work is so challenging, especially to accomplish in a truly meaningful and impactful way, and yet there is a sort of simplicity to this work at the same time. Help us understand how all of that is true.
Yes, yes. I loved, you know, that you pulled those two lines. I think, you know, the important word in the first sentence is seems. It seems hard and it seems impossible. And unfortunately, right, our perceptions become our reality. And so it's challenging because we have to change, right? If we wanted to change, it wouldn't be challenging. It would be elementary, right? And we'd be able to fall into recess, right? We'd be able to play. We'd be able to be curious, right? We'd be able to do those things. And that's really the distinction that I try to pull out in this book, is that it's hard because our narrative has made it seem hard. But in reality, wanting to value people feels really good, right? You try to do that every day. And it's about expanding that practice that you do in the micro to understand the larger siblinghood, right, that we have here in the U.S. And so I think, you know, there are times when I'm like, this is impossible, you know? But I have to remind myself that people with a lot less than I have working, you know, were able to end slavery, right? Were able to at least give us a fighting chance to talk about inclusion. And so that's what keeps me going. But yeah, I think it can seem contradictory because building relationships is actually natural. It's you know, you might be teaching it to your kids right now, right? Those who are listening, right? Like how to be nice, how to be fair, how to make sure everyone, you know, can play and those things. And at the end of the day, that's really what DEI is.
I want to mention that your book is laid out in two sections. Section after the introduction, section one is how we got here, and section two is a blueprint for sustainable change. And that's where this book really becomes very practical in its approach, which I very much appreciate. I wonder if you could take a moment and explain this notion of sustainable change. Again, your second part is a blueprint for sustainable change. The fact that you choose those words suggests that there is such a thing as unsustainable change. I wonder what you mean by sustainable change, and what does it mean for change to be sustainable? I mean, what kind of change does it need to be, or in what way does that change need to be enacted in order to be truly sustainable?
In order for change to be sustainable, you need to actually integrate it, right, into what you do. And I think part of the problem, right, part of what makes this hard is that we put DEI in a place, right? DEI sits in an office, probably somewhere in HR, and they have all these responsibilities of changing sometimes a company that's hundreds of years old, right? That that may have been a part of some of the mistakes we're trying to fix right now, right? And so sustainable change, and this is why I talk about decentralization in the book, sustainable change means that it lives in your DNA. It lives in your culture. It's part of your business model. It's not something that is the side and kind of fits better with your foundation, really, if you think about it, right? It's the understanding that employees and customers, unlike our political conversation, right, employees and customers are very clear on what they want to see from corporate America. And these younger generations are much more active about their clarity. And so you want to actually bring that into your future proofing, right? It's not just technology, but it's your culture and how people understand the world that's going to keep you competitive.
For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with Malia Lazu, who is a lecturer in the Technological Innovation, Entrepreneurship, and Strategic Management Group at MIT Sloan School of Management. And we're talking about her new book, From Intention to Impact, A Practical Guide to Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion. In her own words, the purpose of this book is to demystify DEI conversations and help companies to move from intent to impact. I mentioned in passing a little earlier in the interview how you worked for years with Harry Belafonte and how this was really a transformative experience for you. I want to ask you to tell our listeners a little bit about that, about him and the experience of working with him. But maybe ahead of that, it would actually be interesting and helpful for our listeners and for me, for that matter, to learn a little bit more about you, even ahead of 2003, when as a 26-year-old, you met Harry Belafonte again, working for him. What would be helpful for us to know about your life's journey leading up to that point now just over 20 years ago?
Thank you for that question, Greg. I appreciate that. So I was, I like to say I was probably a born activist, my mother and father would say, my first two oppressors, my parents stopping my liberation. but I always had this, I always had this call for justice, and it was something that I think, you know, sits on both sides of my family. And so when I was 19 and attending college in Boston, I started my first nonprofit. And I think that's really the big thing that your listeners should know is that I was coming from a nonprofit activist organizer space. And I was working for the Institute for Policy Studies at the time in DC. And Harry was on the board there. And so that's how I got to meet him. And the word went around, you know, Harry's coming in, right? Harry's coming in the office tomorrow. Like, wear your finest, right? And we were all, you know, I was going home after that, and I called my mother, and I said, Mom, the guy from the Muppets, because that's how Harry came to me in
wow.
my generation. It was through the Muppets.
Huh.
And my mother was like, no, like, Carmen Jones, like, you know this person, go to the library, because kids, that's where the internet was at the time, was at the library. And I looked him up, and I saw that he had produced Beat Street, which was this movie on breakdancing that I loved, again, very part of my generation. And I literally rapped that song to him when I met him.
Wow. Explain.
And he got a kick out of it, thank goodness.
Explain the circumstances under which you met him. And explain the kind of work that you began doing with him and on his behalf.
So as a board member of the Institute for Policy Studies, he was very interested in looking at how the criminal justice movement, I mean, he was also very interested in their work in Africa, but as it overlapped with my work, how the criminal justice movement needed to be supported, right? And how reform really needed to happen. And that was becoming one of his core focuses. And he had seen a five-year-old girl get arrested in school. And this is what motivated him to bring me into his shop and have him work on starting the Gathering for Justice. And so that was, you know, that it was this amazing opportunity. I moved to New York City and started working with him, doing training and different organizing throughout the country.
As you talk about Harry Belafonte and what he did, and you mention how you have modeled much of your activism after his work, one of the things that he did was to create something called the Gathering of the Elders. I'd love the name, and even more importantly, love the concept. and I feel like in this day and age, there's probably more of that sort of thing that really should happen. Talk about the Gathering of the Elders and what ultimately sprang from that.
So the Gathering for Elders, with elders, you know, it was important for Harry to start, you know, as he was bringing his focus in, right, to criminal justice as his domestic policy. It was really important for him that he brought those who came before, right, those who were of his generation, who had the infrastructure knowledge, right? Diane Nash, right? Jesse Jackson, Paul Robeson's son was there. Dolores Huerta was there. You know, Marion Wright Edelman was there. I mean, it was, when I tell you, like, I was just starstruck. Angela Davis, I mean, I'm sorry. I'm just seeing people walking through the door now, you know, but, and he brought folks together to say, what are we doing? Right, because I'm about to talk to these young people and we're about to organize. Who's with me? How are we doing this? And it was really important for him to gather, you know, and there had to be 60, 70 folks there. I mean, you had, you know, it was an amazing, amazing gathering of the elders. And they had some really honest conversations. And, you know, not everything was all agreeable and loving in the civil rights movement, right? And these are the people who were there, right? Like, so they know, like, you didn't come to my rally, right? Like, not in that petty of a way, but in really, like, understanding what movements take, right? And understanding those struggles. And so for Harry, it was very important that we started there, that we started with the elders. And for me, I mean, it was just, you know, I mean, no college degree can give you the amount of knowledge that, that I had in being there and organizing
right.
such an event.
You describe a series of youth meetings that occurred all across the country. You talk about country meeting city and north meeting south, and it involved engaging with young people who had been involved in gang activity and other violent behavior, and for the purpose of learning. And at one point in describing this, you write these really beautiful words. Instead of just rushing in with solutions and answers, we had to understand more about what this community needed. It just seems to me that those are incredibly important words, and that and it takes a certain amount of humility to embrace the truth of those words, that we cannot go rushing in pell-mell thinking we already have the answers to the problem that we see before us. I mean, it sounds like that was the kind of the heart and soul of the matter there.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, I think Harry, because of, by virtue of who he was, right? Like, he was the Harry Belafonte, right? The first person to sell a million records, the first person to be touched affectionately by a white woman on television, right? All of these things. He could actually sit back and listen, right? He didn't have a scarcity. You weren't going to take anything from him. Right. He didn't have that. And it was really important for him to listen, because what he kept saying at each one of these events was, the agenda is to find the agenda. Mm. Because if you were down with what was put out in the civil rights movement, that's what you'd be doing. Right. But there's a reason why there's this disconnect. There's a reason why. We're not passing down the same type of infrastructure, right? Different infrastructure and is being created. And so he wanted to learn about that infrastructure. He wanted to know what solutions they were bringing, and then how could he bring the institutional to those solutions? You know, this is a person who was almost more comfortable in the streets than he was in the C-suites or, in circles of power. He would much rather be sitting with a group of folks at the barber shop chopping it up, right? Mm-hmm. And so for him to listen to these young people and to go from, black children meeting each other to then these black youth, young people, to meeting the Latino folks who were living similar lives, and then, seeing the indigenous groups meeting. I mean, one of our most powerful visits was in Appalachia. And one of my biggest learnings there was that a lot of these young people didn't think there were poor whites like that. Mm. Right. And so when you talk about, do you know enough about the community to tell them what they should do with themselves? The answer is probably no.
Right. And of course you talk about how there was incredible value in investing the time to listen and in particular to listen and learn. I mean, that it's not just about hearing, but learning from the people that you're talking to. And you call this a very important takeaway for corporate leaders today. It occurs to me, as you're describing this and as we're talking about it, that in some respects these kind of discussion scenarios sort of have a bad rap, or there is a stigma attached to them, that in an organization in which we might work. I mean, this radio station is owned by one college, and my full-time job is teaching at another college, and I can think of situations where, you might create some kind of forum or sort of town meeting to be talking about something, and there are these eye rolls because it's like, we don't need to sit around and talk. We need to, get something done. And I think there is a well-meaning sort of rush to action that sometimes can be counterproductive. Or I think in light of what you write about in this book, it certainly seems like that can be terribly unproductive or counterproductive if you are really kind of rushing through this first phase of, in a sense, learning, in Mr. Belafonte's words, what our agenda really needs to be.
That's right. That's right. When this idea that, you know, we've listened enough, right? Or there's this idea that you know as you're coming in, and, you know, attaching listening to learning is so important. And then, you know, I talk about in the book, and then taking loving action, right? And listening, it's not only because of what you learn, but it's because of the practice of who you become when you listen. And part of DEI is a shift in a power dynamic, right? And I talk about in the book getting curious, right? And so the practice of listening is what allows you to take informed action. And I understand that people want to, you know, you feel horrible, right? Something happens, right? George Floyd, murder, lynching, you know, riots happen, uprisings happen, whatever might be happening to cause people to want to take action. Yes, right? But we need to know what we're talking about, right, before we take action. And if you don't listen and if you don't learn, you end up, you know, being like one of the examples in my book, Walmart creating Juneteenth ice cream, right? Like, that was not an informed action, and it was costly for their reputation. It also costs a lot to pull a product you got to then pull from the shelves, right? Like, these are all costly mistakes when they probably just should have spent a little more time listening in an authentic way.
Absolutely. As you describe this PR mess at Walmart, and you've already kind of covered the basics of what happened in what, you know, perhaps was a very well-meaning attempt to try to observe and celebrate Juneteenth. They created this Juneteenth ice cream that it was not well received, to say the least, by the Black community. And you write, it was the kind of marketing mess that happens when people of color either are not in the room or feel it is not safe to speak up with their honest opinions. And it feels like that is the rub. That is the heart of the matter right there. That when a company operates with almost nobody of color in the room where decisions are being made, they are almost inherently going to be making poor decisions or uninformed decisions. I mean, they are doing themselves, that is, the company is doing themselves a huge disservice when they do not have diverse voices, diverse perspectives in those important rooms where important decisions are being made.
Right. That's exactly right. And, you know, I put in the book those two examples, right? They're either not in the room or they're not empowered. And because both, you see both things happening, right? So it's important for managers and, you know, team members to understand that just because you have someone in the room that represents a different lived experience, it doesn't mean that the culture has encouraged them to share that different lived experience, right? So, you know, when I talk to employees, I often hear, you know, I don't want to be the angry Black woman. So, like, I'm not going to say anything, right? Like, you're trained in how to get along in a company. And sometimes for people with different lived experience, the best way to do that is to actually not be vocal. And so there may have been, you know, I mean, I don't know who was in the room, but there may have been someone in the room who didn't feel comfortable speaking up, or, you know, thought it better to just be happy that they're doing something for Juneteenth and, you know, and not feel empowered to say something. And so I think it's important to, you know, just reinforce this notion of just because you have someone on your team, it doesn't mean that they feel like their lived experience is helpful to their continued success.
Yes, or valued. For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking to Malia Lazu, about her book, From Intention to Impact, A Practical Guide to Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion. The book, as in her words at one point, talks about how the business community continues to fall in the gap between intention and impact. Corporate America has to do better because America is asking it to do better. And this book is a means towards that end. As I said earlier, part one is how we got here, and then part two, a blueprint for sustainable change. I want to just ask you about one matter related to the first part of the book, and that is the notion that perhaps some of the initial efforts, serious efforts towards DEI, diversity, equity, and inclusion, were framed as charitable rather than as a real value-adding strategy for the company. Tell us a little more about how this played out and in a sense, the problem it created for the cause.
Yeah, I mean, I wonder if it wasn't set up like that because those in power who have the ability to set the narrative is how they saw it, right? I still wonder if the business community really does truly believe that a room full of straight white men can produce something better than a room that has diversity, right? Like even if those are all Ivy League straight white men, right? Like I still don't know if they can produce something better than a group of diverse people. But I think we inherently believe that, right? It's one of those norms, right? That this is what leadership looks like, right? So it should be common sense. And I think it was, for me important to point that out in the book.
So in the second part of your book, we have laid out, among other things, the seven stages from intention to impact, and then you kind of ultimately explore some of those matters in terms of how they actually do play out in the real world. And I'm just talking quickly through these seven steps. It begins with excited relief. There's a way to solve the problem. It's kind of about that initial enthusiasm, pledges made, committees formed, first steps are taken. But you tell us, too many companies never get any farther than this excited first step. And it's important to go beyond that to the three L's of listening, learning, and then taking loving action, which we can talk about. And then, once real action is taken on lower hanging fruit, some of the perhaps simplest things that are most obvious things that can be done, then there is the matter of pushback. And actually, you have three steps among the seven that involve pushback, meeting it, the initial pushback, coming to terms with it and understanding what that pushback is. And then ultimately in the seventh step, deciding to move around what is kind of the pervasive bias that is almost certainly present. So there's a lot wrapped up in that, but obviously you are especially concerned about this matter of pushback. Explain kind of the nature of pushback and why it is so important to understand pushback before you, in a sense, can deal with it.
Pushback is why your DEI efforts end up not seeing impact, right? Because it's the culture resetting itself. Right? It's the culture finding its level again, doing what they did, right? I, talk in the book about culture eats strategy for breakfast, the Peter Drucker quote that ultimately was what, one of those mantras that changed your life. But this idea of pushback and how it's accepted in your organization is really going to let you know, are you going to be able to get to impact or not? And You know, I like to put it in three different stages because it starts as seeming very legitimate, right? Maybe, you know, we're just playing devil's advocate. We're just running through compliance. We're just, you know, making sure, you know, legal counsel is cool with this, right? So it seems like, right, that makes sense that we do. And so you don't understand that it's really the culture that's starting to reset itself. And so then when you start answering those pushback questions, there seems to be more pushback, right? And you eventually just have to realize that this pushback is real, right? It's the culture saying, we don't want to do this. So we're going to find all the reasons why we can't. And you either have to decide to continue to respond to every reason, which is going to make you not do the work, or you have to just do the work. And so it was important for me to have people be able to reflect on what does the pushback look like, you know, in their companies right now? You know, is it still very much in, you know, the first phase of, you know, where we're just trying to run things through, or have you already tried to answer those things? Because I think a lot of times the burden is then put on the DEI advocates, right, to then prove that this should be done, rather than the company saying, wow, McKinsey said diverse teams are, you know, 36% more profitable. We should do this for that reason.
I like that notion at the end about, you know, once we kind of get to the heart of what this pushback is based on, then moving through that bias, because that's the only way to put bias behind you. You go on to say that when it comes to creating this change and making sure that it is a really sustainable change, that it might be important to think about change that is not just from the top down. You write at one point, change in companies most commonly happens from the top down. But when it comes to matters of culture, this can feel authoritarian. So you are suggesting that companies and organizations are apt to have much deeper and more meaningful success in DEI when, in a sense, those efforts are decentralized and everyone, in a sense, takes ownership and responsibility for it. Help us understand what that might look like.
It looks like those, you know, I talk about in the book catalysts and champions, right, and pre-existing networks, this idea that you don't need everybody, right? This doesn't necessarily, I mean, it's great when things come down from the top because you need budgets, right, and things like that. But going back to sustainable change, what it looks like is people who want to do something for DEI get to do that. And you don't have to force everyone to do it, right? If I just want to start a book club, I can do that. If I just want to decide to be nice to people, right, and be that person that's the part of the welcoming committee, I can take it upon myself to do that. And so rather than centralizing it through either an office or a pledge, there's probably people in the office that come home and, you know, look at their spouse or their friend or whomever and say, you know what they need to do, right? A lot of times employees have the answers of how you can build more inclusivity and belonging. And so, you know, empowering your employee resource groups to go off and, you know, sing the praises of what they do, right? Empowering departments to take it on because they want to. These things end up changing the culture. You know, what you see ends up happening a lot when it's top down. The manager says, oh, so we're going to do this DEI thing. And someone goes, why? And they go, I don't know. Right. That's not how we want DEI to look, right? That's not how we want to present it, and that's not how it needs to be presented. So there's always folks who are excited about it, let them take that, let them become, you know, better teams, and let the rest of the organization see that. That's how you actually change the culture. I think a lot of this pushback we're seeing is, you know, a natural pushback, not only of, you know, straight white men or certain communities feeling irrelevant, but also because it feels very forced. And I don't want to be forced into a party. You know what I mean? Don't force people to learn how to like me. But let me hang with the ones who do like me.
Right. Well put. I think if I have a single favorite chapter in the book, it's the chapter in which you explore the importance of curiosity. And the title of this chapter, I think, is Creating a Curious Work Culture. And as I was first surveying the table of contents, that was something that did not, you know, make immediate sense to me. And then I started exploring that chapter, and I just hung on every word. I really, really loved that. I think it might be at the start of that chapter, you talk about a transformative moment for you at a point when you were feeling some frustration in your DEI work, when you came across a saying by someone named Peter Drucker. Explain what he said and why it had such deep impact upon you and your work from there on.
So the quote is, "Culture eats strategy for breakfast." And when I read that, I talk about how I ugly cried in the book, and that's totally true. Like, that's not just, you know, me trying to bring in some dramatic flair. And it was because, you know, when you read something and it feels true, right? You're like, oh, right. That rings like truth in my heart. And then I started thinking, all we do is come up with strategy, right? What is the strategy for this policy change? What is the strategy to elect someone who will help? What is the strategy? And we're doing it in this culture that doesn't value us. And so it's not the strategy that's not working, right? These are all brilliant strategies. King had a brilliant strategy. Stokely Carmichael had a brilliant, right? Like, these are all really smart, smart thinking in how to find equity, equality, belonging, inclusion, all of these things that, you know, any human being wants in their society. And what we were going up against was what's known to be fact that isn't. And we all have it, right? I, as a woman, have slut shamed, right? I have not showed up. You know, I have assumed, you know, the guys were the bosses when it was really the ladies, right? Like, we all have these narratives. You know, I was taught that what looked beautiful was not my hair, right? We all have these narratives, and that's why strategy is so hard to get done. Because we're going up against a culture that's just, again, pushing back and just staying in the first three stages,
right,
you know,
right.
But realigns itself, you know, every 30 years, right? Every 40 years, maybe.
So you, I love the way you explore this nature, the nature of curiosity, of true curiosity, of being inquisitive, seeking to learn, seeking to understand, and how when we foster that in a company or in an organization of any kind, It is so important. And I like your differentiation also between being curious and being nosy, where nosy is about judging and comparing, and curiosity is just about acting and accepting. But I especially loved your words that a curious work culture is a culture anchored in belonging, that in a sense that is the ultimate goal for everyone who is part of that company, to really feel like they belong with that company, that they belong and are accepted and respected. And just being genuinely curious about one another is one of the most important pathways to that.
Being curious and you know, like we say in the book, not nosy, right? Not nosy, but being curious allows you to learn about other people in a way that empowers them, right? We all love people being curious about us, right? And one of the reasons why I'm loving this interview, right? Because you're allowing me to explore my own beliefs, right? What do I think? And so when someone's truly curious about you, both parties feel really good. And you can have learning conversations that aren't tense, right? That don't have an electricity to them that's not helpful. And, you know, the Cherokee, I talk about in the book how the Cherokee have, it was one of their core values. And, you know, I'm paraphrasing their definition, but curiosity their definition is that I will become a better person by learning about you.
Love that.
I think that's such a great habit, you know, when you see not only people, but the world, right? Become curious about bees and grass and rivers, right? Become curious because they will teach you something about yourself. They will help you become a better person. And so having a culture that's curious is having a culture that will future-proof itself naturally because it's asking about what's coming. It's very open to hear about what's coming.
Right. I'm reminded of a wonderful scene, and maybe you're acquainted with it or maybe you're not, but from the award-winning series Ted Lasso, there's a famous scene in which the title character of Ted Lasso, who's this American soccer coach suddenly transplanted to Britain and met by a glut of disdain by various people, including in this particular scene a very wealthy man. I won't go into any more of it than that, but this wealthy man has challenged Ted Lasso to a game of darts for quite a lot of money, and it turns out Ted Lasso is fantastic at darts, and as he is methodically throwing these darts, he's essentially lecturing this wealthy man, this wealthy jerk, on the value of curiosity, basically saying that the young people in his life, that is Ted's life, who were always underestimating him, he realized what they all had in common is they were just judgmental. They weren't curious. And Ted Lasso quotes Walt Whitman. I understand he didn't actually say this, but supposedly Walt Whitman said, "Be curious, not judgmental." And he said, those guys who were underestimating me, they thought they had everything figured out, so they judged everything and everyone. And in a sense, what Ted Lasso is saying in that magnificent scene from this show is that genuine curiosity about each other, in a sense, overcomes or undermines judgment. That when we're genuinely curious in our fellow human beings, whatever the color of their skin or their economic background or whatever, that is such a meaningful step, first step, towards greater understanding and empathy and all of the things you talk about in your book.
I love that. You know what? That may have been the best pitch to get me to watch Ted Lasso because it's all, you know, like everyone was doing it. They're like, I can't believe you're not watching it. And now I'm like, oh, wait a second. There's soliloquies like that? Maybe yeah. I will watch it.
Well, it certainly came to mind as I read, as I said, this marvelous chapter in your book about curiosity. And of course, other valuable chapters as well on a company finding its authentic voice and going beyond goals. I mean, time and time again, I found so much of great value in your ultimately optimistic book, From Intention to Impact, A Practical Guide to Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion, published by MIT Press, the author, Malia Lazu. Malia Lazu, congratulations on a really fascinating and potentially valuable book. And thank you for being my morning show guest. I really enjoyed speaking with you.
Thank you so much. I've really enjoyed this interview.
Tomorrow on the morning show, we will be previewing two musical theater events coming up, namely the musical Nine at Carthage College and Peter and the Starcatcher at the University of Wisconsin Parkside. On Thursday, we'll share with you audio from a memorable event last Thursday, which involved Carthage President John Swallow and the University of Wisconsin System President Jay Rothman talking about the future of higher education in Wisconsin. And on Friday, in a departure from our published